Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, who along with the Science and Technology Forum and the Environment and Natural Resources Forum organized tonight's event. And I welcome our audience here in San Francisco live and our radio and online audiences. And I'm very happy to welcome Professor Scott Stevens here to speak about the Yosemite Rim Fire, something that, of course, gathered the entire attention of the Bay Area a couple of months ago. How much land was under fire, and of course, Yosemite being beloved here, what was about to happen. But very interesting topic about the conflict between all the different groups, all of whom have different fire policies, and this is a big issue as to how the outcome comes. So, Professor Stevens.
Well, I'm happy to be here today, talk about the Rim Fire, talk about some of the work we've actually done in the area. Ended up, we had a field crew, I'll tell you a little bit more later, we had a field crew working in the Rim Fire area that were evacuated this year. So we kind of intimately know the area somewhat in terms of some of the forest and some of the area of the fire impacted. Today I'm going to talk a couple of things. One thing I'd like to talk about is first, what did fire used to do in California before your American settlement? You know, just the idea of how common was fire in these ecosystems, or was it uncommon? What kind of areas might have burned before your American influence? We'll talk about that. I want to talk about this data from 1911. This is actually Forest Service. The Forest Service was created in 1905. In 1911, they did a systematic survey of the forest of California. Amazingly, some of those original data sheets are actually still in the San Bruno archive right here in the Bay Area. So we actually got a copy of them from the Stanislaus National Forest, which actually used to include some of Yosemite National Park. So we were out there this summer trying to remeasure the actual places in 1911 that were measured. I'll show you some data from that, see how things have changed. And then the question becomes, if we got some issues with fire and landscapes, how might you mitigate them? What can you do maybe to change that? Can you do some treatments? Can you do something today to try to maybe incorporate fire from an ecological process? And I'll talk about that as well. And then the whole thing about federal policy. Policy is interesting to me because it really is a place where you're going to have tremendous influence. What happens in Washington really matters. I know right now there's some things going on in Washington a little bit crazy. But there is actually strong input of what Washington could do, I think, in this particular instance. Policy, I think, really needs to be revised to actually try to go after some of these challenges. But first, I want to bring us just for a moment to maybe a little bit in the history. National Geographic put out an article in 1956. You see it there. Nathaniel Kenny, he wrote a whole paper on the national forests. He called them the Green Treasury, which is an interesting title. If you read this, there's all sorts of different things in there about the forest, how it was used, had a different view of the national forest at that time, a little bit more of commodities versus restoration or ecosystems. But there's a quote in there. As one fire expert told me, I don't believe that equipment and development alone will show us how to keep having relatively few big fires. Researchers must let their imagination soar for answers that today would seem fantastic. So even then, they were talking about fire, 1956, and they were wondering, what can we do to prevent these big fires from burning in our forests? And Kenny then has this quote in there about maybe technology, something's going to really change that. Well, I have to say, 1956, a big fire in 1956 was 7,000 acres, 8,000 acres. That you look at the record, you can see the data today. You know, you're talking about fires less than 10,000, easy. And the Rim Fire, what was it? It was over 250,000 acres, right? So when you think about how fires changed from the 50s and 60s on, you've seen tremendous change. People could never have forecasted what we see today in 1956. But there was this notion that things, even in 56, there was problems. So the question is, what can you do to fix them? So I'll try to bring that back around at the end of the talk. First thing I want to talk about is the idea of fire regime. A fire regime is actually the characterization of what fire does in a particular area. It includes how often fire burns, seasonality, what type of severity actually occurs, are trees surviving the fire, or are they being killed, frequency of fire, things of that nature. I'm going to bring in a piece of wood here. I'm a forester, so I brought a little piece of wood to share with the audience. And what that is a piece of ponderosa pine. The ponderosa pine is actually a tree that burns frequently. And you'll see on that piece that there's a bunch of small lesions. The fire causes a small injury, kills a cambium layer just underneath the bark. But the tree actually is able to cope with that, grows around that, and then tries to prevent the next fire from killing it. But it essentially opens a wound, just like in our hands or our arms. We get a wound, we hit it, we get another wound. We hit it, get another wound. The same thing happens with a fire scar. So that's a piece actually from Portola. from near Quincy, California, northern Sierra Nevada. It's a piece of ponderosa pine that actually did record fires, and you'll see maybe 15 or 20 of those fires right there on that material. It's an old piece of wood. The interior of that piece is around 1580, and the outside is around 1850. So it's a way that you can actually get physical evidence today of fire. And that's how we know, essentially, then, that the fire regime of most of the rim fire area is mixed conifer forest. And research that's been done by my lab at Berkeley and certainly others show that you're looking at maybe an interval in the past of 5 to 15 years between fires. So about every decade or so, you would have a fire in these systems, primarily from lightning ignition, but some of it also from Native Americans. So fire every decade or so, we can see that literally to even today from physical evidence you could collect in the forest. Collect that evidence, take it back to the lab, process it, date it, and you can get an idea of exactly what fire used to do. You can do that all over the Sierra Nevada. So 1910, we see essentially the fire turns off. Fire record basically goes to zero. And it's coincident with actually the Forest Service beginning in 1905. When the Forest Service is created, it actually had two mandates, to provide a sustainable timber supply for American people and to provide sustainable water supply. That was actually in the legislation in 1905. Interesting they were thinking of water even then. But one thing they actually thought right away was this fire was causing damage. It was killing trees. Regeneration was actually being reduced because of fire. So they came to a discussion. They debated it. They debated it for about a decade or more, and they actually said, we have to get fire out. So we're going to start suppress. And that actually then manifests itself in the tree rings. We see no more fire at all. So it's very frequent until around 1905 or so, 1900, and then essentially disappears. This is a picture that I like to show. This is actually on Plumas National Forest, outside of what we have as the University of California Forestry Field Station, which we call Summer Camp. Summer Camp was actually created right around 1916. And this is a guard station. A guard station was created actually to have a person live there and actually patrol the forest. So this is a forest guard, actually in that picture right there. And their job was to try to make sure people weren't cutting timber unlawfully, put out fires, also talk to people and give people advice. So this is 1915. And then there's some show in Kotok wrote a paper in 1924, and there's some quotes in here which I think are really pertinent to the rim fire. California pine forests represent broken, patchy, understock stands worn down by the attrition of repeated light fires. Excessive crown fires are uncommon, almost unknown in the California pine region. And then the last one, the virgin forest subjected to repeated surf fires for centuries. So these are these folks from the 20s that actually had still could see the landscape in front of them and try to interpret what fire was doing. And if you look at that picture there, you can see that's a very open stand, right? There's not very many trees in there. And the early foresters looked at that and said, wow, there's a lot of potential space to fill with trees. We can grow a lot more timber for the American people. Let's try to grow timber. And by the way, let's do that by actually getting fire out. And that really was some of the early interpretation of thinking about how there was so much more area, we can get more trees in there, and let's just try to do that for the American people. That was really what set in motion the whole idea of fire suppression. So this idea of what did fire do in California? So what we've done is we've taken the literature from fire history data from the piece of wood that you're seeing coming around. So people will take 40 or 50 pieces of that, hundreds of pieces, and actually then date them and then get an idea of what fire used to do. So we take that literature and we summarize it. It includes both lightning ignitions and also Native American burning. Native Americans used to burn for a lot of reasons. Food production, cordage materials, herbs, medicines, warfare. They did a lot of things with fire. So we also try to look at the Native American literature and understand what they used to do with burning. And then using that, we know the area potentially of all the vegetation types. We know the intervals of fire. So all we do is some arithmetic to come up with some ideas of what used to burn. And one thing that you find out is we try to pick 1800, that's arbitrary, but there wasn't a lot of Euro-American influence at 1800. So our study comes up with this notion of about 6 million acres burned in California alone. 6 million acres annually. That's a huge area, okay? That's a big area, 6 million acres. California is 100 million acres almost on the dot. So you're talking about 6% of the state. We actually took out the Mojave Desert because we don't know what fire used to do there. It's very difficult to interpret what the Mojave had. And Mojave is 25% of the state of California. So even if you take out 25% of the land base and just take it aside, it leaves you with 75 million acres. And we estimate out of the 75 million, 6 million acres burned a year. If you compare that to the United States total, we see from 1994 to 2004 that California burns 90% of what burned between the 94 to 2004 annually. So you think of that again. So we're saying essentially that equivalent amount of areas used to burn in California compared to the entire United States of America from 1994 to 2004. Sometimes people certainly call our state the Golden State. I call California the Pyro State. Fire in California was incredibly common. We're talking common, common, common. It was shaping ecosystems all over this place. Oak woodlands, mixed conifer forests, grasslands, wetlands. It was really a profound ecological process. And a little bit of data from 1950 to 1999 shows us that cumulative area burned annually is around 275,000 acres in California. We go up and down quite a bit. There's a lot of variation in the amount of area burned. This year is a pretty big year because we have RIN fires and things of that nature. But if you look at the long-term average and compare it to what we think actually burned pre-1800, we come up with an estimate 6%, about 6% of the area burns today that used to burn pre-1800. Actually, the data from 1999, if you took that data from 2000 to 2013, fire area in California is going up. It's going up from 2000 to 2013. So instead of being 6%, it's around 10% now. We've gone up enough, about 4%. We've gone up since around 2000. So still, even today, when we have these big fires, gets a lot of notoriety, causes a lot of damage sometimes, still the area burned compared to the pre-1800 is 10%. So you think about that in this state, how profound fire once was. And by no means would I ever think that we need to go back to that. It's impossible. We got tens of millions of people living here. We got urban interface areas. We got agriculture. We got cities. So there's no way you're going to think about a fire regime that used to burn 6 million acres in California. But when you think about just how fundamental that fire was, it's a big piece of ecosystem. And you take it out for 100 years, you're going to cause massive change. And that's what we're going to talk about. So as I mentioned earlier, I had a four-person crew of UC Berkeley grad students and undergrad students working in the Rim Fire area this year, and we were going to remeasure these plots taken in 1911. So take a look at some data from that. So this is really intriguing. We all knew that fire used to shape these forests. We didn't really have great information about how much did it. The 1911 data shows us that, on average, the number of trees per acre above 6 inches in diameter, so a tree 6 inches in diameter or larger, how many trees per acre? 1911 points to 19 trees per acre. Now, there's the data we actually collected this summer. This summer, in 2013, number of trees per acre above 6 inches, 225. This is profound change, okay? I was actually shocked. I thought that I knew that we'd have less tree density back in 1911 just based on fire regime, just the physics of the system. But I never thought that we would have densities that low. Most of those trees are pretty big. Those are big diameter trees. The photograph on the left there is actually from the Sierra San Pedro Martir in northern Mexico, northwestern Baja. The Sierra San Pedro Martir is actually the last Mediterranean forest in the northern hemisphere that actually still has a relatively intact fire regime. It's about 150, 120 air miles due south of San Diego. In Mexico, Jeffrey Pine mixed conifer. So that's the picture you see there. Turns out that the data we have from the 19th inventory, and we compare that to our data from the Sierra San Pedro Martir in Mexico, almost identical. Very interesting. It very again surprises me. This is a pretty dry site down in Baja, even though it's around 8,000 feet up. So it does get precipitation, gets snow too. But when we compare the densities of 1911 to contemporary data from the Martir, it's very similar. But that is amazing change. You think about that, 19, 20 trees per acre, up to 225. This is mind-boggling in some ways, okay? And there's a picture to the right. That actually is a picture from one of our 1911 plots. Okay, that's what a 225 trees per acre plot looks like. You got a lot of density. So the question then becomes the Rim Fire. What did it do? We know it's been labeled as the third largest fire in California's history, also the largest fire in the Sierra Nevada in terms of California history. Starts on August 17th, unfortunately, from a camper that was actually an archery hunter. Someone was actually hunting with a bow and arrow that started the campfire and then actually started the Rim Fire. Total acres burned, 258,000 roughly. Remember that 1956 idea? 6,000 or 8,000 acre fire was considered big in the 50s. We're talking about something that's unimaginable, 250,000 acres, 400 square miles, 400 square mile area. The fire effects from the Rim Fire, that's the key. What did it do? I'm going to show you a picture just on the next slide. Cost of suppression, $127 million just for the single fire. If you look at the suppression budget of the United States of America right now on an annual basis from the federal agencies, it runs between $2 and $2.5 billion a year. 2 to 2.5 billion. If you look back in the mid-90s, early 90s, that number was 300 million. So it's gone from about 300 million, 400 million in the early 90s to today over 2 billion. There's no reason to think it's going down. One of the biggest issues is urban interface. Urban interface is causing suppression costs that really escalate. We'll talk a little more about that later. Are we seeing more fires of this type? Should we expect to see more fires of this type? And I have to say yes with climate change. All we're doing is increasing temperature. If you increase temperature, you're just going to dry out fuel. We know that snow was not laying around on the ground as long. It's melting earlier. That just means a longer period in California where fires can burn and spread. That alone is just simply going to mean fires can be more prevalent. Modeling studies confirm that. Tony Westerling from UC Merced has written some nice papers on this. So what did the Rim Fire do? Here's a map of the Rim Fire, and what you have here is the purple is the perimeter, and then the red areas are what we consider high stand replacing fire. So these are places based on remote sensing imagery, Landsat, where you can actually get an idea of how the fire changed the ecosystem. So the area with red, we estimate over 95% of the trees died. It's not just the trees. There's also chaparral in the Rim Fire. There's actually a lot of shrublands, okay? There's a Tuolumne River. Maybe you can see a couple of those rivers there on the slide. The Tuolumne River Canyon is steep. If you go down that canyon, you're really in chaparral country. You're in a shrubland. So that place, almost any condition, when you burn it, it's going to burn with high severity. So all the red isn't forest by any means. Some of the red is also shrublands. How much is something we're still working on? The big patches, if you look at that central patch there, even though you see a little fingers in between, it's not continuous. If you kind of imagine that red patch being continuous, it's 65,000 acres. If you look at some of those smaller patches, you're looking easily 20 to 30,000 acres. 20 to 30,000 acres of really stand replacing fire where over 95% of the trees are dead. If you look a little more to the north, you can see actually that you're beginning to see places where you're getting much more of a variety of patches. You're seeing smaller patches, and you're also seeing a lot of areas that didn't burn with high severity. You would call that, I would think, really the idea that you're going to have more of a restoration. If you have these patches that are somewhat 100 acres, 200 acres, 5 acres, 20, and you still have a lot of forest around that, that really is a restoration. That is something actually that is, if you could achieve that with your burning, you're actually doing a great job because trees are still there. They're able to put seed down. They're going to get regeneration. But when you have patches, 5,000 acres, 1,000 acres, 10,000 acres, and you kill 95% of the trees, you're essentially really causing great change because the forests in the Sierra Nevada don't have cones like in Yellowstone that are serotonous, that hold seed and then drop seed after high severity fire. These cones all mature in about 2 years, and they open up. They disperse seed out of them into the ground, and the cones essentially are kindling. They burn very easily. They don't have that closed cone character because these places used to burn, as you saw from that piece of wood, every 5 to 15 years. There was no reason to have serotony because they're burning very frequently. Trees are still going to drop seed. Regeneration occurs. But if you kill these plants over tens of thousands or 1,000 acres, that seed source can be sterilized. And then essentially what you're going to get is more of a reproduction of shrubs. The shrubs have seeds in the soil, and those seeds can actually live for 60 years. So if you take off the forest canopy, shrubs are really going to have a very nice time, and I expect a lot of shrubs to regenerate this year in the Rim Fire area just because that seed bank is going to be made up to grow. The canopy's gone, a lot of sun, lots of nice light, also a lot of water. There's going to be a lot of water in the soil because the trees aren't going to take in transpiration. So the problem with the Rim Fire is this notion of big areas that have been burned and then dead. There's another map you could look at. It's called the map that actually looks at soil severity. If I put the soil severity map here, it'd have far less red. And you've seen that reported sometimes, even in the papers. The soil map actually says, okay, we're not as concerned about the live component. We're interested in how much material is on the surface of the soil to reduce erosion. So even dead needles that come out of trees that actually drop onto the soil, a soil mapper would actually say that's moderate severity because potential for erosion has been reduced by simply the vegetation or the needles on the ground. When I look at it, I'm always looking from the dominant vegetation standpoint. What's the trees doing? What's going on with the forest? So I look at that, even though there's some needles on the ground, and certainly that could change things like soil erosion, I'm interested in just how many of the trees are dead. So this map essentially shows you what's going on with the overstory, the canopy. So it's not the soil map, which can be actually somewhat confused with it. This is the one that shows you mortality of the overstory, shrublands if it's shrublands, forest if it's forest. So it's the one ecologically that I think has much more meaning. Up there you can see Lake Cherry Lake, Lake Eleanor, and Hetch Hetchy. Those are all on the edge of the fire. You can see Cherry Lake was pretty much burned completely around. Eleanor also, Hetch Hetchy didn't have quite as much burning. But we'll talk about those in a minute, too, because I know the Hetch Hetchy water supply got a lot of discussion here in the state. I pop up the next little slide. That's the Moonlight Fire. So let me just take it back for a moment. So that's the Rim Fire. The Moonlight Fire is just going to come up with the next to give you a scale. The Moonlight burned in 2007. At the time, it was thought to be quite a calamity. But look how small it is compared to the Rim. The Rim, you could probably put three Moonlights into the Rim. The Moonlight Fire was in the eastern Sierra Nevada, outside of eastern area of Quincy. At the time, got a lot of notoriety, but the Rim is certainly a bigger event, just a much larger event. Now I want to show you some pictures. It turns out I was out with my field crew this summer, so that's July 15, 2003, and there's one of the people from Berkeley doing some work on a plot. And she's putting out a tape, so she's measuring some distances. We're actually then taking the diameters of all the trees to get the idea of how many trees there are. We're also doing things like measuring the understory, the shrubs, all that component. So take a look at that picture for a moment. You see there's a large down log there. That's a large sugar pine laying on the ground. So I went back there about 14 days ago and took this picture. So there's the same plot. So there's that large sugar pine on the ground, and there's the forest around it. Okay, and you can see quite a change, a massive change, frankly. Okay. Next picture, I'll actually, side by side, I'll show you another vantage point. That's actually a California black oak, the one that's looking kind of all the odd shapes in the limbs. And there's a lot of conifers around it. You see on the left where it's alive. On the right side, there's after the rim fire. The conifers have no ability to resprout. If you top kill them, if you kill all the needles on them, there's no way for that tree to regenerate. The oak, on the other hand, has dormant buds under its bark, actually also just underneath the soil surface. And that oak's going to resprout like mad. So one thing that's going to happen is the rim fire in the areas of high severity, oak is going to win. You're going to have really significant increase in oak regeneration because the oaks are going to resprout, the root systems are there, and they're going to grow very quickly. But the conifers aren't. So I think places where we have high severity in the rim fire, we're going to see oak actually increase, which actually can be somewhat desirable. Oaks are important species for wildlife habitat for a lot of reasons. So the oaks will actually do okay. Conifers, you can see here, none of these trees survive. Here's another picture. I took this picture because I was curious. There's kind of a row there, if you see, about four trees that are relatively big. Those trees are about 2 feet, 2.5 feet in diameter. There's an incense cedar to the left corner. Then there's actually a white fir. Then there's two ponderosa pines there. Of course, you got 225 trees per acre. These trees were not harvested. Probably, they were probably just underneath the commercial size last time this place was cut. My guess, this place was cut last time in probably the 1960s or 70s. So here you got these remnant older trees, which actually are incredibly important. A lot of these trees have been harvested in national forests over the years. So the old trees that actually provide habitat for animals and such are critically important. What happened to those four trees? There's a picture. Nothing survived. So this tells us again, you know, quite a huge change. You see the soil's exposed. And the forest essentially is, in this particular area, is completely dead. But you saw the picture I showed earlier. There are places inside the rim fire, there's plenty of trees alive. Okay, it just turns out that these plots we were working in that day are in a place where we had really high severity effects and also huge mortality. But losing those old trees is significant. That is a big deal because those are really important. Those trees, my guess, are 250 years old. 250. So how are you going to create another 250-year tree? 250 years. There you go. So it's going to take a long time to create, you know, forests of that type, that character again. And I have one more picture I want to show you here. These are two big ponderosa pines there from the vantage point. And you can see those incense cedars and all the small trees. Some of them are actually dead next to it. So that's a 225 trees per acre. The next picture shows exactly what it looked like just about 2 weeks ago. There's those two big ponderosa pines. Unfortunately, they're all dead, and so are the trees behind. So I don't get too nervous when trees die, frankly, with fire, because there's too many. There's just too many in the forest. But I really get nervous when you look at things like the older components are dying too. I get very nervous when you're talking about an area of 1,000 acres that looks like this. So you have 1,000 acres, essentially, with trees essentially are stand-deading charcoal. So how's that going to regenerate? I'll have to say one thing that was interesting out there. The rim fire burned late in the season. And actually, the trees go through this cycle where they mass their cones. Every 3 to 4 to 5 years, they create a big cone crop, and then they go way down. People think that actually is because that keeps the predators of seeds off balance. if they produce the same amount of seed all the time, the comb predators actually could get to that level and continue to take the seed. But once in a while, if they actually then get a big cone year, they can dump seed down, the predators are overwhelmed, then you can get regeneration. Well, it turns out that ponderosa pine and white fir looked like to me they had a mast year this last year. And some of those cones actually opened when I was out there. They actually had burned, but I saw seeds on the ground that were viable, it looked like to me. So it would be very curious to see what kind of regeneration we might see inside the rimfire. If we did get some viable seed on the ground from these trees, I would call that fantastic because I would not expect it. I would expect most of that seed to be sterilized by the heat of the fire and burned up because we do not have serotonous cones. But I did see some hope maybe of potential for tree regeneration. If that's the case, then the trees will actually compete with the shrubs, but still there could be hope for some regeneration. If you don't have those seeds viable, unless you plant in this site, if you want to plant trees, the Forest Service is now thinking about that, you can plant them and grow them. If you don't do that and just allow natural process to occur in a place like this, my guess is 100 to 200 years to get a forest back. It's going to take that long to get seed encroachment from the edges in. Trees are actually going to mature enough, dump more seed, get it in, dump more seed to get it in. A patch like that, 100 years, 200 years, I would not call out of the ordinary. It'd take a long time to really get a forest back. So those are my pictures of the rimfire pre and post. And then the idea then, what's the challenge with this? Well, the contemporary stand replacing fire is outside historic range of variation. So this is this notion, you're getting these big red patches or the mortality occurring in areas that actually is causing harm because we're losing seed sources of the trees. The seed sources of those trees are not able to withstand that. Most pronounced in the mixed conifer and the yellow pine types, ponderosa pine types. It's not just a proportion. If you look at that map, I didn't tell you, but it's about 37% of high severity inside the rimfire. About 37% of the area is high severity. That's one thing that's interesting. But another thing that's interesting, just tell me, how big are the patches? If it's 37% and most of the patches are 5 acres, I'm not too worried about it. There's a lot of trees around to regenerate the site. A lot of trees survive. But if it's 37% and you have patches of 1,000 acres, 5,000 acres, 10,000 acres, that's much more concerning because those trees are dead and you don't have that local seed source to regenerate the site. So the patch size is really, really critical, not just a percentage. Some places will regenerate to shrubs, others to some trees, 100 years or more to get trees back unless you want to maybe move the system along with some planting. The Forest Service will probably plant some of these areas, but there's no way they can plant it all. It's too big. There's not enough seedlings around, frankly. So they may pick some areas they want to try to regenerate. Other areas are just going to allow natural processes. We'll just have to happen. And the shrublands are all going to come back gangbusters. They're going to do just fine. The Feather River or the Tuolumne River Canyon where the chaparral is all we're going to regenerate starting next spring. It's probably going to be beautiful, frankly. There's going to be some flowers there, fire followers, and those processes are going to be just moving along. The chaparral and the shrubs will be fine. The oaks will be good. The oaks are going to regenerate. It's the conifer forest and those big patches of mortality that are concerning. They're not going to regenerate. So how do you change this? What can we do? Well, if we want to actually think about trying to reduce the probability or the chance that some of these areas will die, there are fuel treatments we can do today, the idea of restoration of these systems. Picture here tries to show us another mixed conifer forest. This is not the rimfire. This is the University of California Blodgett Forest. Blodgett is near Georgetown. Georgetown is a small town in the Sierra Nevada, kind of in between Placerville and Auburn. So this is a place that I've done a bunch of research with my graduate students over the years. So this is a pre-photo. And you can see that tree kind of in the left center. That's a big white fir. It's got a dot on it. That's something we want to keep our eye on in the sequence of photographs. There's something we call the torching index. And there you see it, torching index 22 kilometers per hour. So that's around 12 to 15 miles an hour or so. What's that mean? That just simply means under a day, a typical day in the afternoon, late in the fall in Blodgett Forest, it takes about a 10 to 15 mile an hour wind to basically initiate a crown fire. It takes about 15 mile an hour wind and you can get a crown fire on those days. That tells you it's very vulnerable. You're certainly going to get days with 15, 10 mile an hour winds in the northern Sierra Nevada. So the computer model, which computes torching index, gives us this idea. Now, what we're going to do now is we're actually going to treat this area mechanically first. We're just going to use machines. We're going to do some forest thinning. We're also going to do some mastication of shrubs. And we're going to try to change that ecosystem to try to reduce the potential for burning. So take a look at, remember that tree dead center, the white fir? There's after mechanical treatment. That's that same tree dead center. And you see much more open conditions, right? But you also see, I think, a lot of material on the ground. So you've taken some of those commercial products, you've taken it to the sawmill. Anything around above about 10 inches diameter, we can actually sell to the sawmill. The other materials have to stay on site because there really is no market thing to do with them. So what we've done then is taking some of those mid-canopy fuels, we call those ladder fuels, we've removed some of those, we've sold some of the logs, and we've left the branches and the limbs there. So this is really a conundrum. You're putting more fuel on the surface, but you're taking away some of the ladder fuel. The model tells us the torching index increases to 52 kilometers per hour. That's a good thing. It takes more wind to initiate crown fire. So the model says even with that change of increased surface fuel, we still have maybe a benefit in terms of this system. We've remeasured this site 10 years later, about 9 years later. That regenerated area underneath there with all the fuel is now decomposed by over 90%. Very surprising, frankly. Mediterranean climate, generally decomposition is very low because we know it's hot and it's dry. You need decomposition to occur when it's hot and wet. But since we masticated or, I think, shredded up most of the material, there's a high surface area to volume ratio, and it regenerated or decomposed much more quickly than I thought. So I could show you a picture on this one today, and you look at that site today, it's almost bare ground with shrubs. The woody material's gone. So just natural decomposition actually has tremendous influence on these systems. I was actually surprised. So the next picture is one of my graduate students, one of my former students, Tadashi Moody, were burning this site. So this is prescribed fire. So we're putting fire into the site at night. Turns out this is a great time to burn in the Sierra Nevada because humidity's come up, because temperature goes down. Winds are very predictable. So we burned about 20 straight days to do this work back in the early 2000s. This is a backing fire, so we're actually allowing the fire to go from the top of the hill down slowly, and we're burning through one of those thin stands. So the same thing we just saw previously, where all that activity fuel, all that surface fuel on the ground, and we're allowing the fire to move downhill. One thing about this fire that little surprised me is the residence time. It took around 15 minutes for that flame actually to burn up the fuel. 15 minutes is a long time to have flaming combustion at the base of all these trees. That's a lot of energy. The average flame length there is about 1.5 meters. So about 1.5 meter flame length, bathing those trees for 15 minutes. Mortality actually was lower than I thought. It was around 5%. We killed about 5% of them. But we did do a pretty good job with the surface fuel. So here comes the next photo. Remember that big white fir? There it is. So there's that tree we started with, and then this is after the burn. You can see now that I've listed the torching index is greater than 500 kilometers per hour. The model actually has no applicability at that velocity of wind. But one thing we can say is this is a stand now that's incredibly resistant to initiation of any type of crown fire. We essentially took out the energy. The energy of the surface fuel is key. There's so much energy in those fuels. Those energy then can provide vectoring of fire into the crown. If you remove surface fuel in these systems, by some means, you're going to increase the resistance and really increase the resiliency of the forest. And that's exactly what we saw here. So this idea of restoration could actually go in line with trying to reduce potential for mortality. Now, this slide I wanted to show for a moment talks about how are we doing? How are we doing as a California state in terms of restoring forests in the Sierra Nevada? So the Forest Service in the Sierra Nevada mechanically thins around 29,000 acres a year in the Sierra Nevada National Forest land base. Prescribed fire, just over 8,000 acres a year in the Sierra Nevada National Forest. Wildfire burns around 51,000 acres a year, if we look at maybe the last 15-year average. So if you actually add all those up, the 28,000 mechanical, 8,000 prescribed fire, and all of the wildfire, and you put that into this one lot, it's around 88,000 acres a year. And by no means is all that 51,000 acres of wildfire restoration. Some of that area also has patches that are too big with mortality, just killing trees over scales that are too large. But even if you just assume that all of it is restorative and you put it into that category, essentially what you're seeing in the Sierra Nevada is about 18% of the area that used to burn with fire being treated with wildfire, mechanical, and prescribed fire. Less than 20%. Malcolm North wrote this paper and actually then tried to estimate what was going on. If you look at the annual treatment on the far left on the graph, you see a teeny little bump. Okay? That's what's going on today. If you look at the center graph, that's what we think is going on by forest type. different colors are actually different forest types in the Sierra. That's what we think the historic is, about that size. And then the backlog is the idea, if we continue on at the annual rate that we're doing for the last 10 years, and we project this out, say, for 30 years, 40 years, what we're saying here is 60% of the Forest Service acreage in the entire Sierra Nevada will be untreated permanently. Essentially, it's an untreated category, because if you take the area that we're treating mechanically with prescribed fire and wildfire and actually then project it out based on the land base over the next 30 years at the current rates, even wildfire is not going to hit 60% of the land base. It's a permanent backlog. That's what we call it, the backlog. I call that a freight train. Because if you're talking about forests that used to have 20 trees per acre, and today you got 250, forests that used to have surface fuel loads probably around 10 tons per acre, today they got 40 tons per acre, and you have that type of forest condition over millions of acres in the Sierra Nevada, and we're headed to a climate change where we're increasing temperature, we're going to have a longer fire season, and we have potential for fire to do things. Having forests that vulnerable to actual fire severity at large spatial scales is totally unacceptable. Because what happens is when those things do burn, we're not getting pure restoration. We're getting restoration in some areas, but we're also maybe getting half the area with severe degradation. So that is really something that gets our attention, thinking that 60% of the area of the Forest Service land base with current rates of treatment are going to be basically held on in those conditions that are very vulnerable. That is a major, major problem. It's something that is not sustainable. It frankly is not sustainable, period. So the question then becomes, what about the restoration treatments I showed you from Blodgett when we do the burning, when we do the mechanical treatment? Is there ecological harm associated with that? That's a legitimate question, and it's been asked by a lot of people. I actually wrote a paper with a bunch of colleagues in 2012 that actually tried to look at the literature on this for the national scene, the entire United States, not just in California. And we came up to this conclusion: most ecosystem components exhibit very subtle effects or no measurable effects at all, including soil, small mammals and birds, vegetation, bark beetles, and carbon sequestration. So the literature tells us the restoration treatments that we tried to just talk about, the mechanical thinning, the burning, they seem to be restorative, and they actually are causing more ecological benefit than ecological harm. I think the literature on that is pretty darn strong. In contrast, a large high-severity fires can cause great problems. So this is where a policy shift may be a big issue. I think we could actually think that we need to do more restoration of these systems, trying to get treatments into them so when they eventually do burn, we can maintain forest canopy. And then suppression costs in the urban interface are really, really dominating a lot of the suppression today. And you know the federal government doesn't really have any jurisdiction in the private urban interface. But still, they put millions and hundreds of millions of dollars every year into suppression. So in our paper that just came out this week in Science, a policy forum, we actually recommended that actual local government and state government should pay for interface suppression, and that should allow more money then for the federal agencies to actually do restoration in forests. This is a big deal, and this is not something that's without controversy. Okay, this is a big deal. I know it is. I've gotten a lot of comments on this, like you're crazy. But if you think about where we're headed in terms of the cost of the interface, is probably maybe half of what's going on in California today. Half of the fire suppression budget, maybe just interface protection. When the Rim Fire started, what happened was all of the suppression sources went to structure protection first, all of them on the west side of that fire, because there were about 400 houses there. And they basically tried to, keep those houses safe and keep people safe, which is what they needed to do. But then the wildland side actually didn't get much attention. I want to spend just a couple minutes now, instead of just looking at restoration for mechanical means. This is Yosemite National Park. This is actually Illilouette Creek Basin there in the center bottom. And the picture to the right is a mosaic of lightning fires that have been allowed to burn there since 1974 without suppression. So this is a place where lightning fire is allowed to actually burn and do its work. Here's a picture of one of them, the Hoover Fire in 2001. And this photograph tries to show you that some places where the fires are burning, those are different perimeters, each fire. The left side of the figure shows when fires are hitting previously burned areas, 1 year, 7 years, that those previous boundaries that are burned 7 years ago or 1 year ago are putting the fire out without any suppression at all. The fire essentially is self-limiting because previous areas burned, fuels are down. On the right side, you see numbers like 23 years, 30 years, 13 years. Those fires actually are much older, And the next fire that comes along with a dark outline is burning right over them. So those we call reburn fires versus self-limiting fires. And if we look at some statistics on this, what we find out is that if you're an area that burns 9 years ago or earlier, so anything that burned 9 years, 8 years, 7 years, 6 years, and the next fire comes along and hits that in the Illilouette Creek Basin, it basically puts it out within 100 meters. The fire goes out on its own. A self-limited system because of fuels. So this idea of fire actually shaping forest, causing great change, but having a fire every decade or so in some areas, and then allowing fire to burn in places like Illilouette Creek Basin and Yosemite, and lo and behold, it's putting itself out, self-regulated. Here's Cherry Lake. This is actually Cherry Lake. I was out there a couple weeks ago, and you can see there's some areas that actually burn pretty severely around Cherry Lake, but the vast majority is actually decent. I see very little watershed damage here. Even in places like the one here in the foreground where we have mortality, we also have shrubs and oaks. And if you think then about Hetch Hetchy, Hetch Hetchy has really benefited from the park's management of wildland fire for the last 30, 40 years. The park has been doing things like managing lightning fire around the Hetch Hetchy watershed and also managed ignited fire since around 1978. And when the rim fire blasted into that area, it moderated fire behavior instantly. So today, Hetch Hetchy is actually in darn good shape. And one reason is because the park's fire management policies for the last 40 years. I know the manager of the park pretty well. They tell me the Hetch Hetchy foresters are always giving them grief when they're burning around the water supply. They're always worried, my God, you're going to do something wrong. We're going to get erosion. We're going to kill too many trees. So there's just always this feedback about, well, you're causing harm. You're getting us nervous. Well, lo and behold, the Hetch Hetchy manager should be patting all the Park Service managers on the head right now, saying thank you very much. Because those previous fires mitigated really rim fire damage to the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir. There is actually potential that the Hetch Hetchy system and the area around it in the federal national park lands, because of budget cuts, that burning could be really reduced. So that active burning program going on for 35 years potentially could be reduced significantly. I say down here that I would think a partnership with Hetch Hetchy Water System, National Park Service, and things like the Nature Conservancy might actually make sense to make sure it keeps going. If you're headed into climate change where it's warmer and you got more fire on the ground, you want to be able to mitigate adverse impacts, and you want a water supply like Hetch Hetchy, which I know is a world-class one, you want to maintain that fire program up there. You want to maintain that heterogeneity. You want to maintain the resiliency of that ecosystem. Denver, maybe a few years ago, remember, had their water supply system burned up with a fire outside of Denver to the west, blasted their water supply. They put in $17.5 million the next year to try to mitigate effects. Down in Santa Fe, New Mexico, they're actually trying to do a partnership, too, to try to conserve water that includes both the water supply, Nature Conservancy, and the Forest Service. I would just say a comment that I think this is high time that places like Hetch Hetchy System probably partners with some of these folks, maybe Conservancy and others, and maintains a fire regime program to sustain the water supply of Hetch Hetchy. If that fire program goes off, there's going to be impacts. There are going to be major impacts. It's going to take 30 years, but I guarantee they're going to come. So I think some ideas maybe to try to benefit that would be huge. I'll just close here with go back to our friend Nathaniel Kenny. The idea of imagination soar, Kenny was right. Imaginations need to soar, but the idea is bring fire back. Don't take it out. At the time when that paper was written, the idea was all fire out. But Kenny never could have thought of that the idea would be somehow to bring fire back or bring restoration back into these forests. It is unimaginable in 1956. But today, it's clear. We have to have fire or some sort of active treatment inside these watersheds to increase resiliency in the face of climate change and then get our ecosystem services like wildlife habitat, water, aesthetics, everything else. The next 1 to 3 decades is critical. The Forest Service right now is actually revising their land management plans in the entire California land base. The first three are the Inyo National Forest, the Sequoia National Forest, and the Sierra National Forest. Right now, they're going through the exercise. They have not been revised since 1982-83. So this is an awesome opportunity, once in a generation, where these Forest Service plans could be revised to incorporate some of the ideas we chatted about today. So I'm actually somewhat optimistic that this thing could actually make a big difference. The next 1 to 3 decades are critical. My idea is just try to give the managers of the future some ability to actually make decisions to conserve these ecosystems and their water and the other aspects. I'm afraid with the course we're on right now, if we don't change course, I think in 50 years from now, when our kids maybe are in this room talking about fire and ecosystems, they're going to look back and say, wow, those people in early 2000s, they kind of knew what was going on a little bit.
that, man, look what we are today. We're in a mess. And why didn't they act? Why didn't they do something back in 2012, 2013 to change the trajectory of these systems in the face of climate change? I hope that our legacy is actually the positive side of that coin. And that's all for me.
Thank you very much, Professor, for that very detailed and very interesting approach to the Yosemite Rim fire. I'd like to remind our audiences that they're listening to Professor Scott Stevens speaking at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. Now it's time for questions.
Scott, I'm still a little confused. Historically, in the 1800s, you said that the density of forests was substantially lower than it is now. And so one way to look at it is, well, we're in fact have forests that are fixing a huge amount of carbon, which is good for the climate issue. And yet at one level, it sounds like the forest being too dense, it's a forest risk. And is there some way of establishing a policy that creates a mean where, or do you have an opinion about what the mean might be as to how to manage this properly? Right?
No, that's a great question. Carbon and forests are something that really gets our attention today. They're thought of as a place to sequester carbon to store it. There's a concept of carbon carrying capacity. So some people actually have thought about this idea. If you have, how much carbon could you actually have on land kind of sustainably in the era of like climate change and fire? And people, including us, have done some work on this. And even though I was showing you there's 225 trees per acre there, if you took out maybe two-thirds of those trees, which are small, you're probably only going to reduce potential carbon, at least in places that have some big trees, by less than 15-20%. So you can take maybe 20% of the carbon stocks away and then produce a forest then that's so much more resilient to actually keeping that carbon on site for a longer period and sequestering carbon for the future. I'm afraid with the 225 trees and the surface fuels there at 40 tons per acre, when it inevitably does burn, you basically lose a lot. It's not all going to disappear at once. A lot of decomposition has to happen. But I would say that it's more interesting to try to look at sustainability or this carbon carry capacity. One thing I'll have to say, though, is you're right in some ways, is right now, even with climate change, with our fire suppression organization, which is very efficient, there's a chance about 1 in 200 for a particular watershed in the Sierra to burn every year. About 1 in 200 chance. That's not a big chance, really, right? But you know the Sierra is big enough that eventually you're going to get some. But if you actually, some people can make the argument that it's since we're only a 1 in 200 chance of actually causing big fire and causing mortality, let's just keep pushing the carbon onto these forests. Let's hold onto that carbon, try to mitigate the atmospheric CO2. I actually say that eventually that's going to turn. And I think that the idea of carbon carrying capacity at maybe 80 or 75% of that level, allow the big trees to live and grow. They actually grow and put more carbon on more than those little guys. Try to maybe grow larger trees at bigger spacing and have a carbon carrying capacity. But it's something that actually is still being researched, and it's a legitimate question.
Have there been any economic studies of what you've done at Blodgett that could be extrapolated to larger areas? In other words, if we were to do, say, 1% of the forest this year with that type of restoration compared maybe with 2 years from now, then do 2%, gradually increasing to allow budgets to handle that.
Yes, that's another really interesting point. Blodgett's been managed by UC Berkeley since 1933. That's when it was actually donated to us by Mr. Blodgett from the Michigan California Lumber Company. But Blodgett has always had this notion of trying to grow relatively large trees. So Blodgett has a relatively high component of large trees, like the pictures I showed you a moment ago, where you can have easily trees 3 feet in diameter, 4 feet in diameter. But you also have an excess of trees from a fuel standpoint, easily in the 10, 15, 20 inch. If you have trees that are in that 10, 15, 20 inch diameter and they're excessive, those trees will pay pretty significant amount of revenue. The Blodgett harvest, we harvested about 140 acres in the early 2000s, and we actually made on the order of $300,000 in revenue above all expenses. including all the harvesting, all the burning, everything. So we made $300,000. I'll have to say the Forest Service is a little bit more of a riddle for this for me, because when they look at their land base and the way they plan, one reason is they plan very differently. At Blodgett, we can do a timber harvest plan, which is a state requirement, get it approved basically in maybe 3 months. The Forest Service goes through something called NEPA, which is a National Environmental Policy Act. It takes them probably 2 to 3 years to go through a planning process to get a document through public review, public comment. In a democracy, that's important. But it takes them 3 years to do it. So the planning costs are exorbitant in the Forest Service side. And then that probably then makes it very difficult to make an economic return like we did at Blodgett. But I'm convinced, one thing you can say for sure, the Sierra Nevada is a very productive ecosystem. We got great soils, we got good moisture, we got trees that grow. We actually, I think, could make break even pretty easy. You could probably at least allow it pay for itself, maybe subsidize it in some places where large tree component is actually lacking. You don't have 15-inch, 20-inch trees in excess that you need to harvest. But I think you could actually potentially break even. But I think actually this is another issue that my view is one thing about Congress. I think Congress really could get involved in this to try to make it more efficient to do planning and more efficient to actually get programs on the ground. We have a lot of great institutions like the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the National Environmental Policy Act. All of them kind of move in parallel. All of them actually have staffs. All of them are very, very strongly adhered to by a lot of people. But when they get down to the point where you try to actually create a restoration idea over a large land base, things get complicated. It's like, okay, we can't burn because it's always going to give us smoke. Well, by the way, we have spotted owls over here, so you can't do anything on this area. Oh, by the way, you know, the clean water tells us we can't have any sedimentation at all, but if you have a wildfire, you can have a bunch. So this is where I think Congress can get involved. I really think there is real need for some sort of integrated approach with all these acts that would allow planning to be more efficient and point towards the end of restoration, not timber harvest, but restoration, and thinking then that is a profound thing we could do in an era of climate change. I think the way we are right now, it's very difficult to think of doing this economically and also doing it at any scale that makes a difference, frankly.
So we need a Joint Chiefs of Staff for the environment, huh? That's how the military started to get together. Next question. Well, I have a question that I've always wanted to ask about environmentalists. If there's climate change, wouldn't that, and it's warmer and warmer, wouldn't that, I know not in all areas, but overall increase the forest, increase the plant life, and wouldn't that partially take care of the carbon sequestration that people talk about?
There actually has been research on this, and we know CO2 levels are up, and we know that plants basically take CO2 in for photosynthesis. Yeah, so there is somewhat of a fertilization effect, that where you do have more CO2 in the atmosphere, that you can actually sequester more carbon. The challenge with that is things like temperature, because we know with temperature increases, we also know plants are going to take more water to actually live and actually photosynthesize. So a little bit of a tension there. But there's no doubt that I think that climate change and fire and this idea of kind of increased CO2, forests will regenerate slightly faster. They seem to actually go a little faster for a while, then they kind of taper off. People have done work in plantations primarily, places that are more uniform versus a forest with a lot of heterogeneity. But the increase in CO2 can increase sequestration from the atmosphere. But again, I think the challenge is thinking about the carbon carry capacity. Matt Hertow, actually at Penn State, come up with this idea. And I think it's right on the money. Do we just want to stock carbon onto forest and then somehow maintain it in an era of changing climate? And we're talking about fire a lot today. Insects is another big issue. You know, insects can also change forest profoundly quickly. You've seen that in the Rocky Mountains, you know, some of those systems. We're lucky because we have multiple species. Mixed conifer forest has 6 species of conifer and hardwood. Rocky Mountains got lodgepole pine. So when the mountain pine beetle gets to a point where it actually can move, it's got all this habitat to move on. You're never going to see that in the Sierra because we have diversity, thank goodness. We have different species. We have different bark beetles that basically kill them. So we're not going to see quite that scale. But I think still, if we just maximize carbon on stems, eventually we're going to have western pine beetle and things like mountain pine beetle, and we're going to also kill tens of millions of trees just with insects. So that's why I think the idea of carbon carrying capacity, try to get sustainability to the site, allow it to actually incorporate fire, insects, disease, and still grow and regenerate, maintain that genetic diversity. That's where I think we need to head. I'm really nervous about the idea of just putting more carbon on forest and somehow thinking we're going to keep it.
What about the effects on the fauna? Because it seems like they have way less space to live now and critical habitat. Sort of how does that all work together?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, the Mern Fire, one of my colleagues, John Keene is a Forest Service researcher from Davis. And John worked on the California spotted owl, the great gray owl, and also on other species. He told me the other day that he thinks that 43 spotted owl nesting sites burned over in the rim fire. Not all 43 were burned with high severity. Okay, how many? Maybe 40 to 50%. So a massive change of their habitat there. And the great gray owl is actually a very rare species. It actually lives on meadow edges. So the meadow, and it actually lives next to the meadow, and it actually forages in the meadow. They're actually very rare, and John is very concerned about their habitat as well. So this is the real conundrum, because we know that the spotted owl, in particular, likes to have these multi-storied canopies, kind of like the picture I showed you right off the bat, the 225 trees per acre. They like to work in those areas today. When people look for them, and they hoot them, and they actually find out their habitat, we see them have a preponderance to that habitat type. You got to wonder then, in 1911, with the data we have, where do they live? Did they live maybe in riparian areas, places maybe with a little higher canopy cover? But right now, essentially, what we do, and this is beginning to change, what we try to do is we try to map all of the spotted owl territories, and those territories essentially become places where no management occurs at all. It's like the idea of a static approach. Somehow we're going to maintain that habitat, we're going to maintain those spotted owls, and we got them all mapped out. Challenge with that is dynamics, the dynamic of these ecosystems. Those places basically are not going to maintain themselves for a long period of time into the future. So I think that's that tension again. Do we do something to reduce their susceptibility and maintain some of them? One place in Quincy, Meadow Valley, is an area that we did a bunch of work in a big watershed. John has been watching the spotted owls there for a number of years, had a big restoration area, probably a scale of 25,000 acres. I think before the treatment, there were 7 spotted owls. Today, there are 5 pairs. So 2 pairs left based on the treatment. Question then becomes, is that actually desirable, undesirable? John Keene actually would argue, I think, I've heard him talk about this, that 5 pairs in a more sustainable environment is probably better than having 7 pairs in one that actually is very unsustainable. So those are really interesting questions, and those are not easy to answer.
I'm impressed with your optimism when you have such a complex problem that human beings might be able to manage it. I mean, that's especially a government facility. That might be doing it so.
Yeah. I'd love to comment on that. I have trouble viewing the insects as the problem as opposed to the human beings.
Yeah.
And the reality that, I'm blown away by the optimism that you're expressing, but the reality is that your point of view has to be inserted into a much more complex political problem, which is the human being itself and the impact that we're having. And the hope is that eventually people like you are asked to be part of the planning system. Are you yet being asked to do that? Or what is?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think some people have talked to me over the years, and I gave a talk at a policy conference about three weeks ago in D.C., it was actually in the Senate meeting rooms underneath the U.S. Senate. The Senate staffers were there. The U.S. senators were doing other things. But I gave a talk there, too, and I was probably the only one in a two-day talk that actually had optimism. Most folks really felt bad, you know, that the idea that, you know, we can't move forward, we seem like we're in gridlock, we're really challenged. And Congressman Garamendi actually went to a colleague just today to actually think about what they might do in the House of Representatives and maybe address some of this, and they actually asked me to get on a phone call with them today. So I do have, you know, contacts like that once in a while, and I'm optimistic. I really am. I guess one reason I'm optimistic is I think people in general really want to have forests to be conserved for the future, you know, for our kids and our grandkids. There's just this tangible thing that, you know, these forests are incredibly important, you know, and that's an unbiased, that's a biased opinion, right? This is not a scientist talking. This is just the cathedrals of these forests, how important they are to our kids, how important they are to us. So when I look into the future and think of climate change and then basically these changes that are headed, and they're coming down pretty severe in places, that I just feel that eventually human creativity and positiveness is going to prevail. But you're right. Right now, certainly, I actually talked to the staffers from the U.S. Senate committee 3 weeks ago about this. They said this is completely off our radar. We can't even think about this. We think it's important, but what's going on right now in the nation's capital, this is nothing we can touch right now. So does that mean a new Congress? Does it mean a new president? I don't know what it means. But I still think there's hope for really some innovation here. And maybe you could do it on a place and then try to show that maybe it begins to work, kind of an area of maybe 100,000 acres or 300,000 acres, show the trials and tribulations, but show that maybe you're making a difference. I'm just afraid if we don't do something like that, that in 50 years from now, our kids are going to be banging their heads on the wall and saying, why didn't they act? How come they didn't come with some sort of political compromise solution? And now we're in such grave changes, you know, that I just feel that that's why I'm more optimistic about it. But you're right. The reality can bang you in the head.
Yes, the reality is time is up. And but the very nice thing about that optimism, though, is I think it's justified. There are several things where we actually have done something. You know, ozone was that problem was semi-reversed, the pollution in the lakes, in the Great Lakes. And it took a lot of time, a lot of political problems to get it there. But people, I think what it needs is another crisis. And the Yosemite Rim Fire, it was a nice visual reminder of what this can do, and that's why I wanted you to come and talk about it. So thank you very much for coming, Professor Stevens.
Yeah. My pleasure.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club of California in its 111th year of enlightened discussion.